Hello, and welcome to another Compliance Week podcast. I'm Aarti Maharaj, Digital Content Editor, and this week's podcast features Leon Blanc, Regional Compliance Officer of Bank of China. Leon has worked in the financial sector for almost 20 years. In the past, he served as a Regional Compliance Officer of both KBC Clearing and Commerce Bank. In his daily work, he touches on all aspects of the compliance domain, including anti-money laundering compliance, sanctions, monitoring legislative developments, training staff, and much more. In this podcast, I'll be talking to Leon about anti-money laundering compliance in the Netherlands and what companies should know as they try to conduct business in this part of the world. Our first question is, how is anti-money laundering compliance different in the Netherlands as opposed to the rest of Europe?
Well, Aarti, actually, compliance in the Netherlands is mostly based on European regulation. So our Dutch anti-money laundering law is based on the third anti-money laundering directive. So in that way, it's the same as in other member states of the European Union. What is different, however, is that in the Netherlands we have the Twin Peaks model for regulation. So our central bank does the regulation on financial stability, and the Financial Conduct Authority in the Netherlands, it is called the AFM, does the supervision on financial conduct. So we have two big regulators both looking at this at the same time, but on different topics. So this model has been very successful in the Netherlands, and it now has been copied also by the UK, so now also the UK works with the same Twin Peaks model.
And to clarify, Leon, I'm sorry, did you say Twin Peaks?
Yes, Twin Peaks, like in the TV series.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's like Twin Peaks, like the one peak is the Dutch Central Bank, and the other peak is the Financial Conduct Authority.
Great, understood.
And actually, the regulator gave a presentation last week, and they said actually in the middle of the Twin Peaks in the Netherlands, there's a first peak, is the ECB, the European Central Bank, and that is because of the single supervisory model that they're rolling out. The ECB is rolling out the single supervisory model, and that is part of the general trend in Europe that our power is being centralized on European level and not really on local level. So what you see in the Netherlands and also in other European member states is the local regulators get less and less power, and the European regulator, like in this example, the European Central Bank, gets more and more power. So actually what will happen in the future is that joint supervisory teams of the European Central Bank, could be Germans, could be Frenchmen, could be Belgians, they will perform regulatory oversight to institutions in the Netherlands. They will come over to us and they will inspect our financial institutions to see if they're complying to European standards.
Great. So now that you've pretty much set the context for AML compliance and highlighted the different regulations and the regulatory bodies, I know that AML legislation in the Netherlands is quite comprehensive. Can you talk more about the legislation and how you make it part of your compliance culture?
Yes, Aarti. Well, to begin with, like I said, the Dutch anti-money laundering legislation is largely based on European legislation. So the Dutch law on financial supervision, it's called the WFT, is largely based on lots of European regulations, such as the European Savings Directive or the or MiFID, for instance. So the regulation on how to deal with equities and derivatives. And the Dutch anti-money laundering law is largely based on the third anti-money laundering directive. So being a small bank of a large international parent means that you have to comply to, in this example, to European legislation. For a great deal, also U.S. legislation, because we also, as Bank of China, where I work for, we also have a branch in New York. So we also have to comply to U.S. legislation. Because we're a Chinese bank, we also have to comply to Chinese legislation. And finally, we have some local Dutch specifics. So to get to the second part of your question, how to make it part of the compliance culture, it's very important to communicate changes in legislation in a very early stage. So to monitor legislative developments on the one hand, and on the other hand, to communicate changes as soon as possible, to set up a project group to prepare trainings and to update the intranet, to inform all the employees via emails or newsletters. And so before this new legislative development becomes into practice, that you are prepared for it, and when it is actually rolled out, you can easily implement it and roll it out in your own organization. So for instance, the common reporting standard, I don't know if you have heard about this.
No, definitely explain. That would be helpful.
The common reporting standard is the follow-up, actually, of the FATCA law. Do you know FATCA?
Right,
FATCA.
Yes.
Okay, FATCA is of course, the American law on tax compliance for foreign accounts. So we as a European country have to comply to that. As a follow-up, the CRS has been developed by the OECD. So
right.
So that means that that we are not only going to inform the US tax authority about our data of our customers, but also other countries are going to inform about the data of our customers. So we can have like a level playing field on who pays taxes where, etc., etc. And that's a legislative change that has been going on right now. This week, I talked to the Ministry of Finance, and they are working on a law proposal to get this information into the Dutch law, and then we have to comply to it. So we are now already informing our staff about this change is going to occur. We're organizing trainings and sending emails and updating our internet, so everybody is informed. So when this comes into play, and it will be from the 1st of January, so that's in 3 months already, we will be ready for this new piece of legislation we have to comply to.
Mm-hmm. I like your idea of communicating change. I feel that's a very important part of any culture, corporate culture, as a matter of fact.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
so against that backdrop, I'm sorry, Leon. Go ahead.
No. Yeah, that's certainly true, and I think it's especially for a compliance professional, it's very important to communicate what you're doing to make the people aware that the compliance department is there, and that they're like they are there to ask questions or to drop ideas about integrity and ethics. So we are there, and we have to make ourselves known so that everybody knows and how to find us. And we have also a role in informing people about legislative changes. I once spoke to somebody was working in another company, and he was working for over there for about 2 years, and then he finally, it was a very big company, so that's dependent on how big the company is. But this person was working there for 2 years, and then he finally noticed that there was a compliance department in that company, which he had never heard of before. I think that's really not such a good idea. I think that when you have a compliance department, you should be very active and make yourself known.
I agree with you on that one. Just like a lot of employees know that there's an HR department, a communications department, you need to know that there's a compliance function that exists and where it's located too.
Exactly, and it's my personal ambition to make myself known to all employees of the bank at least once a week, and to inform them about changes that are going on, status of ongoing projects, etc., etc., so that at least once a week they are informed about what is compliance doing and what's going on. What went well, and what can we expect for the future?
Right. That's a great idea. And with that in mind, you've been in the business for about 20 years now. Am I correct?
Yeah, well, that's correct. Yes. But I was not always a compliance officer. For the last 7 years, I'm working as a compliance officer. That's correct.
Great. So what are some best practices in AML compliance have you seen over the years?
Well, Archie, like I just said, communication is key. So communication is very important when you're working in a compliance department. Make the people aware and know that you are there. Make yourself known and involve people and let them also do some thinking on ethics and integrity within the country. Unfortunately, AML compliance gets a lot of attention in the press, but it's always in a bad way. So, and also in the Netherlands, we have seen some scandals. For instance, the Rabobank has been involved in a scandal about manipulating the LIBOR interest rate in London. So that's, you're aware about it. Well, so that's not such a good case for AML compliance, but, you know, that's what gets into the press. And unfortunately, best practices get less attention. So the first one I said is that communication is key. The second one is, I think it's very important to have a robust compliance framework in place. So to let you know your customer and your customer due diligence procedures and processes in place to actually meet your customers, look them in the eyes, and visit the premises of the corporate customers that want to onboard. So those are like very easy steps, but they're very important because the front, especially the front office, has to realize that they are like the first line of defense. So they are the eyes and the ears of the bank. So they should say they should do business in a commercial way, sure, but also in a way, you know, that is integrity, that has integrity. So also think about the risks that are involved in onboarding new customers. So they should be aware about it. And I always say to my staff, I say, okay, when something just doesn't feel right, and you don't even have to have facts in your hands, but when something doesn't feel right, just tell your manager or tell me, and then we can do some extra investigation. And if it turns out okay, then you can proceed, and there's nothing going on. But if it's not okay, then we can take appropriate steps. So it's a very important role for them to be the first line of defense. After you've done your customer, obviously you're going to classify your customer in a client classification risk score. such as, for instance, low, medium, or high risk. And then it's very important to have a risk-based approach, which is actually also in the European regulations, is in the Dutch anti-money laundering law. And it's also, I think it's very a good example of a best practice to have your ongoing customer due diligence based upon a risk-based approach, and also the transaction monitoring based upon a risk-based approach. When you're talking about the best practice example, actually in the field, I think it's difficult. Like I said, the bad news gets in the press, and companies are doing really well on AML compliance. They are not really getting into the press. I have one example. This is one also a Dutch company who was working in Nigeria. And Nigeria is a very tough country to work with because of the huge risks of corruption, the bribery, money laundering, criminal activities, etc., etc. And this company is called Brunel, and it does provide temporary workers for other companies. So, what I don't know the English word for it, actually.
So I'm guessing it's something like a third party?
Yes, it's a third party, and it provides temporary workers.
Workers, right.
Yeah. So, and it chose to leave Nigeria because it said in a statement that it was not possible for them to do business in an honest way. And I think that's the best practice example. I think this is a very courageous step. Lots of companies, also Dutch companies, are still in Nigeria, and they have to think about, okay, some people are getting out of this country just because of the compliance and integrity risk. So we have to rethink about our own position on this. So I think this is a good example of a best practice in AML compliance.
Absolutely, and I have to admit, you raised a very interesting point about third-party risk management. That's mm-hmm. where a lot of businesses, sometimes they don't provide training for their third parties, and this is where compliance issues can surface.
Yes, that's certainly true. Third-party compliance is a trend. In compliance, it becomes more and more important every day. Like you said, it is important to have a robust compliance and legal framework in place, which at first focus on your customers, so you know your customer and your customer due diligence. But secondly, you also have to look at your third parties and to do due diligence on them. And also, lots of international laws, they provide the obligation to train the staff of your third party. And also, to draft up agreements with them in which you're both, you both promise to do business in an honest and integer way, and that's, I think it's very a logical step going on from customer due diligence to third party due diligence. There's lots of work to be done still for lots of companies. I think generally in compliance, financial institutions they take the lead. So in financial institutions, third-party due diligence has already a very big and important place. But other companies also, it's also one international trend. Other parties also have to comply more and more to anti-money laundering legislation. So for them it will be very important too, and I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that you know who you do business with, that the persons that you that you provide probably with large, possibly with large sums of money, because of the services they provide, it doesn't end there. You have to, you have to know where this money goes, and to be certain that it's not some kind of fund for criminal activity, or even worse, for maybe for terrorist activities or something like that. So I think it's a good thing.
So
we haven't seen the end of that.
Exactly. And in that sense, that's where due diligence comes into play, and it can help a company tremendously in fighting corruption.
Exactly.
Moving on to my final question to you, Leon. When it comes to AML compliance, what should foreign companies keep in mind, especially those conducting business in the Netherlands?
Well, Archie, you should know that the Netherlands is very well internationally connected. It has a very robust legal framework and logistical situation in place. So it's very well international connected. This is a advantage, you might say, but it also attracts companies, for instance, multinationals, for tax reasons, and they tend to have really complex ownership structures, which are mostly tax driven. So when you come to the Netherlands, and you find a multinational which has their head office over here with lots of I'm sure you're well aware, a lot of American companies also have their head office over here.
For example, Starbucks.
Yeah, Starbucks, for example. I don't know how the ownership structure of Starbucks looks like, but I'm pretty sure it's pretty complex, and that makes it very challenging for you to do when you do your due diligence work, to really find out who is the ultimate beneficial owner behind this company. So this is one thing. The second thing for the Netherlands, it is internationally connected, I already said, and it's very small. It's very small. The Netherlands is really a tiny country, so we have lots of foreign countries around us. So we're really in the course of centuries, we have really specialized in trade. So we do lots of trade, as you might know. The Rotterdam is the second largest harbor of the world. So lots of trade come in, import, export, everything comes in and goes out of the harbor. And that makes it also an interesting connection point for trade-based money laundering. So a specific problem we face in the Netherlands is the money laundering which is based on trade. So when you do your trade finance due diligence, for instance, a letter of credit or a guarantee or something like that, you have to be very diligent on who is the applicant, who is the beneficiary, what's the background of the beneficiary, what's the background of your applicant, which correspondent banks are involved, and which goods are we really talking about. So to make sure that we're complying, not only to sanctions, because like trade finance is mostly related to trade to sanctions compliance, but also what are the what is the ratio behind this specific trade? Is it logical, or is it kind of strange or unusual? And when the last thing is the case, well, then actually we have the job as a financial institution to make a SAR, suspicious activity report, to our FIU, the Financial Intelligence Unit, and they have the duty to investigate further. So we can leave it with them, but we as a bank have a very important role to be aware of the presence of trade-based money laundering, to do very diligent customer due diligence, so to really look at the deal and on the merits of the deal to see if it's logical, if it makes sense, yes or no. And when it doesn't make sense, we have the role to, you know, to report it to our authorities so they can prosecute further. And then we have, then we have fulfilled our role in keeping the bank, the customers, our third parties, but also society, safe, you know, from criminal activities.
Great. Thank you very much for this, Leon. It's very helpful, and we appreciate you walking us through AML compliance in the Netherlands.